Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 163 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and on this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 25 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, from my triumphs, and from my mistakes. I have got a great show for you today. I'm going to continue my series of episodes in which I dig into the Dungeon Master's Guide. And today we are going to be talking about magic in your world, in your campaign, and things to do with magic. So that should be fun. But before I get into all that good stuff and before we crack open our DMG, I have some announcements and a few short little topics I want to talk about here at the top of the show. So earlier this week, I did the third live stream, the third Game Master's Journey live stream, and had a lot of fun doing that. So if you were able to watch that with me live, thank you so much for coming. And if not, you can go to my YouTube channel and you can watch that whenever you want. So definitely check that out. I do these live streams now every month. I do them on the first Wednesday of each month at 3 p.m. Pacific time. And we have these monthly live streams thanks to the support of the patrons. That was one of our milestones, one of our goals on Patreon, and we've hit it. So now I get to do these live streams every month, and they're a lot of fun. It's a way that you can interact with me and ask questions or suggest topics. And for an hour, I just talk about whatever you want to talk about. I didn't really have too many people asking questions this week, so I spent a lot of the time talking about a new campaign I'm working on to run in my homebrew world of Primordia, and talking about some of the resources for players that I've been working on to prepare for that campaign. And that's basically what I talked about this time. Also, another announcement. I'm really excited to make this announcement. You can now get Game Master's Journey t-shirts and other swag. This is so awesome. I want to send a huge shout out and thank you to my wife, Nikki Starwalker, who has helped me get this going and in all honesty has done the lion's share of the work getting this going. And I really appreciate all the hard work she did on all the designs. So we have multiple designs available featuring some of the album art from Game Master's Journey, both present and past, and some of our logos and things like that. We've got designs for Game Master's Journey. We've got designs for Starwalker Studios. And we even have some designs for my adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. And you can get all kinds of stuff. This is over on Spreadshirt. You can get sweatshirts. You can get t-shirts. You can get coffee mugs. You can get these designs on all kinds of things. So head on over to the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com, and there you can find a link to our store over on Spreadshirt, and you can check out all the cool swag that we've got. And, you know, not only can you, you know, sport the latest summer fashions, but you can also support Game Master's Journey. And I'm looking forward to getting some of these shirts myself. I might have to. When I get the live streams going, I should wear one of my shirts, huh? That'd be pretty cool. Also, just a quick reminder to check out my actual play of The Hidden Shrine of Tomawakan on YouTube. We took a couple weeks off due to the holiday and some work conflicts with my work schedule on my end, but I think we're gonna get going strong again, and we're about a little over halfway through that adventure and having a lot of fun with that. We play on Mondays at 6 p.m. Pacific time. And finally, I'll just remind you that my adventure, my first published adventure for D&D, The Trickster's Labyrinth, is available. It's on sale at starwalkerstudios.com, and you can check that out. And that's another way that you can support me and support what I'm doing here. So thank you very much. And I appreciate everyone's support. I really, really do. All right, let's see. Oh, yes, of course. I also want to take a moment here at the top of the show and send a huge thank you and a shout out to some listener GMs of the show who've joined the esteemed ranks of the patrons of Starwalker Studios. So I want to send a thank you to Zoe Rich, Michael Miska, and John Q. Public. Thank you so much for becoming patrons. And I also want to send a thank you and shout out to Trent Hopkinson for your donation on the website over at starwalkerstudios.com. So I really appreciate those of you who help support the show and help keep this project and this venture going for everyone to enjoy. So just a reminder, if you'd like to support the show, if you'd like to become a patron, for just $5 a month, you can receive access to our patron feed with bonus content, including all the archived episodes of Game Master's Journey and GM Intrusions. Only the most recent episodes are in the free podcast feed that everybody has access to. If you want to go all the way back to episode one, or you want to check out GM Intrusions, you can do that as a patron. Also, you will get access to all of your bonus audio content through a private RSS feed that you can subscribe to using whatever app you listen to podcasts with. So it's super easy, super convenient, and you really get a lot of value for just $5 a month. Of course, I have other reward tiers above and beyond $5 where you can get even more cool things like access to my Primordia design diaries, where I share some of the homebrew stuff that I come up with for my games and for my setting of Primordia. So I hope that you will consider becoming a patron, and you can find a link to my Patreon page in the show notes for this episode over at starwalkerstudios.com. So I think that is it for my beginning of the show spiel and housekeeping and all that good stuff. So let's, without further ado, move on and check in with our Dungeon Master's Guide. All right, so as I mentioned before, we are going to talk some more about the Dungeon Master's Guide today. This is a continuation of a series of episodes in which I am going through the Dungeon Master's Guide for 5th edition page by page and just digging in and talking about all the cool things that we can find in the DMG. And this is great for any of you who maybe haven't had time to read the entire DMG, or maybe it's been a while and you need some reminders of maybe things that you missed, maybe things that you forgot about, or maybe just some old friends you'd like to hear from again, rules and options wise. So today we are continuing our exploration of chapter one. Wow, we're really taking our time getting through chapter one, aren't we? But we are going to be talking about magic today, magic in your world. And this is on page 23 of the DMG in chapter one. And let's see what the DMG has to say to us about magic. In most D&D worlds, magic is natural, but still wondrous and sometimes frightening. People everywhere know about magic, and most people see evidence of it at some point in their lives. It permeates the cosmos and moves through the ancient possessions of legendary heroes, the mysterious ruins of fallen empires, those touched by the gods, creatures born with supernatural power, and individuals who study the secrets of the multiverse. Histories and fireside tales are filled with the exploits of those who wield magic. Well, that sounds pretty exciting. So what normal folk know of magic depends on where they live and whether they know characters who practice magic. Citizens of an isolated hamlet might not have seen true magic used for generations and speak in whispers of the strange powers of the old hermit living in the nearby woods. So, you know, this, like a lot of the things we've been talking about here in chapter one of the DMG, this starts getting into world building and getting into your setting and deciding, you know, how you want these things to work in your world. You know, the DMG is giving us some of the assumptions that are commonly made in the various published settings of the world, but you know, that may or may not be true for your world. It may be different in your world. And that's something that you can and probably should think about. So part of this can be kind of what flavor of fantasy you're going for. Are you going for high mythic fantasy, or are you going for more low fantasy where magic is more uncommon? And even in the published settings, we do have some variety. So some of the DMD? I think I did. What I meant to say is that some of the D&D settings have more magic in them than others. On Athys, the harsh world of the Dark Sun setting, arcane magic is a hated practice that can drain life from the world. Much of Athys's magic lies in the hands of evildoers. On the other hand, in the world of Eberron, magic is as commonplace as any other commodity. Mercantile houses sell magic items and services to anyone who can afford them. People purchase tickets to ride airships and trains propelled by elemental magic. So right there you see a pretty wide spread in even among the published settings of how much magic there is in the world, or how commonly it's used, or how much exposure an average person in the world would have to magic. And in your world, you could be anywhere between those extremes or something even more extreme if you wanted. So the DMG considered or presents some questions that you can consider when thinking about this for your setting. Is some magic common? Is some socially unacceptable? Which magic is rare? And this is something that could obviously vary from place to place in your setting. For instance, what magic might be common or socially unacceptable or rare could be one thing in a large city and something totally different in a very small village. How unusual are members of each spell casting class? How common are those who can cast high level spells? That can have a really big impact in your world. You know, if there are, like, for instance, in the Forgotten Realms, there are high-level spellcasters running around all over the place, it can become difficult for players to wrap their heads around why on earth their characters would be involved in anything important when, you know, there's all these high-level spellcasters running around that could probably handle things much more easily. If, on the other hand, in your setting, high-level spellcasters are less common, or maybe the only high-level spellcasters for the most part are player characters, then the players feel much more special and much more relevant and much more empowered in that setting. And it makes complete sense that people, even world leaders, come to their characters and ask for help because, well, who else are they going to go to? There is no Elminster to save the day. So, you know, those are things you can think about when you're designing your setting. And again, keeping in mind that this can vary from place to place within a given setting. So it's also a way to think about where do you want to set your next adventure within whatever world you're using. How rare are magic items, magical locations, and creatures that have supernatural powers? At what power level do these things go from everyday to exotic? You know, that's something else to consider. So it could be a thing in your world where magic is just uncommon and rare, period, across the board. And it doesn't matter, like the average person doesn't see any manifestation of magic. Or it could be that spellcasters are fairly common, or at least low-level spellcasters are fairly common, but maybe magic items are pretty uncommon. So it's not unusual to see someone cast a spell, but seeing an actual magical item is rare or even unheard of. Or you could flip it around and say that magic items, or at least maybe low-powered magic items, like say common and uncommon magic items, are fairly common in the world and aren't a big deal, but people that can actually use magic are more rare, and maybe only adventurers and really important NPCs. How do authorities regulate and use magic? How do normal folks use magic and protect themselves from it? The answers to some questions suggest the answers to others. For example, if spellcasters of low-level spells are common, as in Eberron, then authorities and common folk are more likely to have access to and use the results of such spells. Buying commonplace magic isn't only possible, but also less expensive. People are more likely to keep well-known magic in mind and to protect against it, especially in risky situations. So that's a really good point and something to remember, not just here, but in any world building that you do, is to think about, what does this mean? How does this impact other aspects of the setting and other aspects of the game? You know, for instance, like it's talking about here, if magic is really common, then when the player characters go out and adventure, it's much more likely that foes that they encounter are going to have protections of various kinds against the more common magics that are used, including the spells used by the player characters. If, on the other hand, magic is more rare, then such things would be less common. So, you know, to kind of give an example in my world I'm working on of Primordia, you know, magic overall is a fairly common thing. The world is suffused with magic. Magic is seen in the skies at night in a phenomenon very similar to the Northern Lights here on Earth. But in Primordia, that is seen as a manifestation of magic itself that's in the world. And although I would say in a tiny isolated village, if those existed in this time period in my world, which they don't so much, but if they did, in those kinds of places, you know, people might not really see magic on a day-to-day basis. They, you know, a tiny little village wouldn't have spellcasters, or wouldn't be any magic items there. And with the exception of the lights in the sky and other natural phenomenon like that, you know, most people in such a remote place wouldn't really have any experience with magic. But in a city, on the other hand, like Alondria, people would see magic. Now, it's not, you know, as commonplace as a place like the Forgotten Realms or Eberron. You know, Alondria doesn't necessarily have street lights on every street that are magical and things like that. But there are visible manifestations of magic. For instance, Alondria has fields that are in caves underneath the city. And these fields are lit by magical light on a 12-hour day-night cycle. So they grow crops under the city, underground. And so that is a manifestation of magic that everyone in the city is familiar with. And even if everybody hasn't gone underground to see the subterranean fields, a lot of people have seen them. And especially ironically, the more lower class people of the city are more likely to have seen them than the upper class. So, you know, in that way, magic is fairly common. So now we talk about any restrictions on magic that there might be. Some civilized areas might restrict or prohibit the use of magic. Spellcasting might be forbidden without a license or official permission. In such a place, magic items and continual magical effects are rare, with protections against magic being the exception. Some localities might prohibit specific spells. It could be a crime to cast any spells used to steal or swindle, such as those that bestow invisibility or produce illusions. Enchantments that charm or dominate others are readily outlawed, since they rob their subjects of free will. Destructive spells are likewise prohibited, for obvious reasons. A local ruler could have a phobia about a specific effect or spell, such as shape-shifting effects if he or she were afraid of being impersonated, and enact a law restricting that type of magic. So that's something to think about too. And again, that's something that very likely will vary from place to place in your setting. So, you know, one city might have a lot of rules about magic and another city might have very few or have very different rules. So this is really interesting. And this is something that I want to give more thought to when it comes to Primordia and what I want to do in my world of Primordia, especially as regards any laws that might exist. Now, something that's interesting about my city of Alondra is it's protected by the equivalent of a mythal. And the mythals of the Forgotten Realms commonly will restrict or even eliminate access to certain kinds of magic. So a mythal might make it impossible for necromancy to be used, for instance, within its area. So it's very possible that the energy field that the mythal surrounding Alondria handles a lot of this kind of stuff, like not allowing necromancy or not allowing destructive spells to be used within the city or things like that. The problem with using the mythal to do that, though, is that it's kind of it is what it is, right? You know, if there's a law that says you can't cast evocation spells in the city and a player character wants to cast a fireball, they can do it, but there's going to be consequences or there could be, right? I mean, maybe they'll do it in such a way that they get away with it and no one knows they did it and there are no consequences, but there could easily be consequences, but the character can still do it. The player can do it. But if, on the other hand, if the mythal just says, no, fireball spell won't work within the city, then the player can't use fireball, you know? So it's a different dynamic to think about. And that's how I tend to think of these things as both a DM and a world builder is, you know, what is the flavor that I want to have in the setting? But as far as how I go about doing that, what are the impacts that's going to have on the player characters? So when I first came up with the idea of my cities being protected by mythals, I originally just kind of assumed that every city there would be certain spells or even schools of magic that wouldn't work there. And I have implemented that in some degree in that the mythals all prevent teleportation across their boundaries or any kind of planar travel or anything like that. So I've done that, but I thought they would restrict even more than that potentially. But then when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, do I really want to do that? Because everything that the mythal restricts, you know, player characters just can't use those spells in the city. And especially if I'm going to have an adventure or a campaign that has a lot going on in the city, that could be kind of a drag for the players if they're like, oh, well, half my spells don't work in the city. So that's kind of a drag. Less so for a wizard or a cleric because they have plenty of spells to choose from. But a character with known spells like a bard or a sorcerer, that could be a real drag if most of the spells they know they can't use in the city. So I think that if I decided to restrict magic in some way, that I would probably favor having laws and go about it that way, as opposed to saying that the mythal prevents that magic from working, with the exception of the teleportation magic, because that just makes sense for the setting that doesn't work. And really, it's not that limiting. I mean, player characters can still teleport all around the city. They just can't teleport from inside the city to outside the city or vice versa. And they can travel the astral plane and the ethereal plane while in the city. They just can't cross the mythal on those planes. They'd have to do so on the material plane. So it doesn't make those magics completely useless. Same thing with like planar travel, like plane shift. You know, you'd have to leave the city to cast it. So it doesn't make them completely useless. And it's also, you know, like how often do you really teleport from the city to another place or vice versa. You know, it doesn't happen that often. And the times that you do it, it's not really that big of a deal if instead of teleporting directly to the city, you teleport, you know, outside the city and then you walk in or whatever. And also there's the portals. You know, if you're going from one city into another, you just use a portal. And why waste a spell slot or a charge on your magic item, right? When you can use a portal for free. So, you know, that's the exception. And I don't think that's super limiting. But as far as other things like saying, oh, you can't use necromancy or you can't use summoning spells or whatever I might come up with, I think I would rather do that with laws that exist in the city, because not only does it give players a little more agency or a little more choice, because they can choose whether to observe that law or not, where the mythal, they don't have a choice, but it also allows for more interesting storytelling. Because, you know, if the mythal just says you can't summon fiends inside the city, it's not possible, then that's it, end of story. But if there's a law that says you can't summon fiends, well, a player character could decide to summon a fiend, and whatever happens, it's probably going to be interesting and could make for a good story. All right, next we have schools of magic. The rules of the game refer to the schools of magic, abjuration, illusion, necromancy, and so on, but it's up to you to determine what those schools signify in your world, if anything. Similarly, a few class options suggest the existence of magic-using organizations in the world, bardic colleges and druidic circles, for example, which are up to you to flesh out. Nice of them to leave it up to us, huh? It's always nice to have the option, but it'd be nice if they give you some of those here in the PHB, or well, I guess we're in the DMG right now, but if they gave you some of those in the PHB, you could decide that no formal structures like these exist in your world. So that's one way you could go. Wizards and bards and druids might be so rare that a player character learns from a single mentor and never meets another character of the same class, in which case wizards would learn their school specialization without any formal training. However, if magic is more common, academies can be the embodiments of the schools of magic. So you could actually have a necromancy academy and an evocation academy, or maybe there's one magic academy and then it has different sections or departments for the different specializations or the different schools, or you could do something like Hogwarts, right? And instead of the different houses, you have the different schools of magic that people specialize in. Or actually, what's even more like this is break bills from the magicians, because they actually have different parts of the school that are based on the different types of magic that exist in that setting. So that's exactly how this could work in your world. These institutions have their own hierarchies, traditions, regulations, and procedures, and may also be organizations that player characters can earn renown in, as we discussed in the last DMG episode on factions and organizations. So you could come up with a renown system for your different magical academies and things like that, and come up with what do player characters get as they earn rank with these institutions. That'd be pretty cool. For example, Materos the Necromancer could be a brother of the necromantic cabal of Tharzad. As a sign of his high standing within its hierarchy, he is allowed to wear the red and green robes of a master. Of course, when he wears those robes, his occupation is easily identified by those who know of the cabal. This recognition could be a boon or a nuisance, since the cabal of Tharzad has a fearsome reputation. So I do something very much like this with my guild of adventurers in Primordia. So it's much more than a magic college or whatever. It's for really all the classes in the game, all types of adventurers. But like what they're discussing here, there are signs of standing within the guild that people outside of the guild recognize. The most notable of those is the guild cloak. So a big part of my guild of adventurers is the idea of teams, of adventuring parties, like what the players are part of, what the characters are part of, considered as teams that work together as part of the guild. And the guild is made up of teams. There's not so many just solitary members of the guild. And those that do exist tend to be like high-ranking members who have probably retired from actual adventuring and they're just doing administrative things now. Or maybe the rest of their team got killed and they decided to retire at that point. Things like that. But most members of the guild are members of an adventuring team. And in fact, to become a member of the guild, you do so as a team. You don't join the guild as an individual. You join as part of a team, and your team either makes it or not as a team. So the guild cloak is a way to show not only your affiliation with the guild, but also show your affiliation with your team. So guild cloaks traditionally have three colors, and each team picks their own three colors. A lot of times they'll have like a coat of arms or some kind of symbol that represents their team. And, you know, the colors and these coat of arms on the cloaks show your team affiliation, just like sports teams. You can recognize them by their colors. But the cloaks overall themselves show your affiliation with the guild, and there's something that people will recognize. And just like what it's talking here, you know, that can either be a good or a bad thing, depending on who you're dealing with and what the situation is. So the way I commonly handle this in the game is your cloak and your known affiliation with the guild can either be positive, neutral, or negative. If it's neutral, then it just doesn't have any effect. If it's positive, maybe you're dealing with someone who respects the guild, and you being a member in good standing of the guild is seen as a positive thing in their eyes, then the fact that you're wearing your guild cloak and they know that you're part of the guild could give you advantage on social roles with this person, things like that. On the other hand, if you're dealing with, for instance, someone not from the city, someone from a village or a small town or something, who is more prejudiced against magic and adventurers and more fearful of people who use magic, them seeing you in a guild cloak could give you disadvantage on social roles and things like that, because it actually makes them less likely to want to help you. So that's a really easy way to handle it. And then the guild is also an actual organization that the player characters can have rank and renown within. So it's kind of all those things in one. Now, I've thought about having an actual magic academy or something like that. I kind of like to do that above and beyond the guild, but I think it's actually problematic just because of the way magic is handled in the game. I mean, if you just look at, quote, arcane magic, if that even means anything anymore, which I would argue it doesn't really, you know, you've got wizards, you've got sorcerers, you've got warlocks, maybe bards, right? And they're all using sort of the same magic, but they're doing it in different ways. So it seems like if there were a magic academy, it would be either for wizards or for sorcerers or for bards, right? It wouldn't be for all of them. At least to me, it doesn't make sense that it would be for all of them. Because for one thing, I mean, other than wizards and bards, it doesn't even make sense. I mean, I don't know that a sorcerer would have an academy, right? Like their whole thing is they just learn to do it naturally. Like they just figure it out. They don't necessarily go to school to learn how to do magic like a wizard does or like a bard might. Same thing with a warlock. So yeah, I don't know. And what do you do with like your arcane tricksters and your eldritch knights? And so I just feel like if you try to have these magic academies, it just gets really messy really quick. And it's almost easier just not to do it or to use organizations that are based around other things other than just magic, or just have a lot of academies that are very, very specialized. Right. Instead of having like one academy for magic, like, for instance, in the Wheel of Time, you have the Aes Sedai. Right. And there are other channelers in the world other than the Aes Sedai. There are other magical traditions, to use a D&D kind of way of thinking of it, But for the majority of the world, the Aes Sedai, like they're it. And you're either Aes Sedai or you're not. And if you're not, then you're kind of like a renegade. But most of the people that are learning to use the One Power are going to the White Tower to learn, and they're becoming Aes Sedai. And I think that's really cool. And that's really awesome. But I just don't think that really works with D&D, because there are so many different classes that are using magic in so many different ways. All right. Let's see if there's anything else in this section we want to talk about. If you go this route, you can treat schools of magic, bardic colleges, and druidic circles as organizations, using the guidelines for organizations presented earlier, which we've already discussed. So, yeah, I guess that's what we have to say about that. As I totally screw this up. Let's try this again.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill Podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
All right. Well, man, I really screwed that up, didn't I? Yeah, so I'm a little lost here. What we're even doing? Ah, here we go. We are supposed to be talking for a minute about the patrons and giving a shout out to the patrons as I immediately derail myself completely. So I want to thank the patrons of Starwalker Studios. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to help support the show and give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. It's the patrons that are giving us the bonus episode every month and the live stream every month. And hopefully I'll be doing more and coming up with even more content for you through the support of the patrons. So I really appreciate the patrons helping out, and I hope that you'll check out my Patreon page. I also want to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 5 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
The man.
Thank you so much, Steve. And thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, I think I'm back on track here. I hope I've got everything under control, and we're just gonna keep soldiering on and try to get through this today. Just bear with me. So our next topic is teleportation circles. The presence of permanent teleportation circles in the major cities helps cement their importance in the economy of a fantasy world. Spells such as plane shift, teleport, and of course teleportation circle connect with these circles, which are found in temples, academies, the headquarters of arcane organizations, and prominent civic locations. However, since every teleportation circle is a possible means of entry into a city, they're guarded by military and magical protection. As you design a fantasy city in your world, think about the teleportation circles it might contain and which ones adventurers are likely to know about. If the adventurers commonly return to their home base by means of a teleportation circle, use that circle as a hook for plot developments in your campaign. What do the adventurers do if they arrive in a teleportation circle and find all the familiar wards disabled and guards lying in pools of blood? What if their arrival interrupts an argument between two feuding priests at the temple? Adventure ensues. So yeah, you know, that's definitely something that you want to think about. I mean, these spells exist. Teleportation circles exist, unless you're going to remove them from the game. So, you know, if technology exists, people are going to use it. So you know, maybe not every city in your world has teleportation circles, but some of them at least probably should and probably do. And, you know, like anything, how you decide to handle this is going to have ripple effects throughout your world, throughout your setting. And, you know, it's something that you definitely want to think about. Not only, you know, how do I want to handle this? You know, do I want to have teleportation circles? And if so, you know, where are they located? Where do they go to? Things like that. Great. Hope you can't hear the buzzsaw in the background. But if these circles exist, then what does that mean for your world? How does that impact things like trade and warfare and relations between different settlements? So in my world of Primordia, things work a little bit differently. There aren't so many teleportation circles, at least not in the cities, because of the mythals, which I've already talked about. And those prevent teleportation even via circles across their boundaries. So, you know, you can use teleportations within the city of Alandria, or teleportation circles, I mean, for instance, to teleport from place to place within the city, but you can't teleport out of the city. In the same way, if you're outside of a city, you can't teleport into a city. So the way that this has gotten around is through my portals, which are special magical constructs that are the only things that allow this kind of travel from within one mythal to another or outside of it. And so cities that trade with one another are connected by these portals. And that's the only way that you can travel magically from place to place if you're dealing with these mythals. So there are teleportation circles that exist in the world, but they're used, like I said, to travel within a city. So there might be teleportation circles in different wards of Alandria, for instance, so that the people that have access to them can quickly travel from one place to another within the city. And they also were used in cities that don't have mythals, but it's believed that those cities have all been destroyed since the breaking of the world and the coming of the rifts and all that good stuff. So, you know, those probably don't exist anymore, but the circles might still be there. And then sometimes they're used to get near a city. So, for instance, Alandria has a very secret teleportation circle that's nearby the city, but outside the mythal, that the guild will sometimes use to either send someone from the city somewhere else or allow someone to return to the city from somewhere else if they're not coming from somewhere that has an actual portal. But of course, just like the portals themselves, these are very heavily guarded because, you know, like it says here in the DMG, you know, that's a possible avenue for attack against that city. It's a weakness in its security. So it's definitely something you're going to want to keep an eye on. All right. So finally, we have a discussion on bringing back the dead. When a creature dies, its soul departs its body, leaves the material plane, travels through the astral plane, and goes to abide on the plane where the creature's deity resides. If the creature didn't worship a deity, its soul departs to the plane corresponding to its alignment. Wow, right there is a whole boatload of assumptions, right? That you can accept or reject when it comes to your world. For me personally, I'm okay with the idea of souls traveling through the astral plane, going to live on the plane where their deity resides. Although, you know, huge inherent problem with this, and I've talked about this time and again on the show, but these D&D settings, a lot of them, and definitely the Forgotten Realms, which is kind of the core setting of the game, are presented as polytheistic settings in which people worship more than one god, and in which having a quote patron deity, like one god that you especially worship, is unusual, and most people, you know, don't really have a patron deity. That's more like clerics and things like that. And yet this is saying that you go to the plane of the deity you worship. Well, what if you worship 9 different deities? You can't live in 9 different planes at the same time, right? So huge problem there. And that's just a problem, period. The other problem with this is more of a personal problem I have with it, is this idea that each deity lives on a plane, and that plane has an alignment. The deity has an alignment, and you go to the plane of your alignment if you don't worship a deity. And I don't like that just because I'm not a huge fan of alignment. And, you know, I've also talked about in past episodes how alignment has been largely removed from the game, with the exception of a few sentient magic items that care about what alignment you are, and this with the outer planes. And other than that, alignment is really just a descriptive thing for role playing and doesn't really have any mechanical meaning or impact in the game. And those are kind of a couple holdovers from older days when alignment was more of a mechanical thing, and you had spells like No Alignment and Detect Evil and things like that, which you don't have anymore. You don't have the No Alignment spell anymore, and the Detect Evil and Good spell actually doesn't detect evil or good or alignment at all. The spell is completely misnamed. It instead detects beings that are from somewhere other than the prime material plane. So it's really detecting outsiders, to use another term from a previous edition. It's not detecting alignment or detecting evil. So they kept it that way probably for you know, to keep the name of the spell what it was before, even though it works completely differently now, and it, you know, it doesn't detect evil anymore. So yeah. So, you know, you have to decide for you. You know, for me, I'm still, you know, thinking about this. Different ideas I've kicked around. I've kicked around the idea of all of my gods living on a single outer plane, and that way, you know, we don't have to worry about which plane you go to. Everybody goes to the same outer plane, and the gods just live in different parts of it, kind of like Mount Olympus kind of thing. I've also thought about just having each god have their own plane and have the outer planes and all that, and just throw out the whole alignment part, which I don't think is really that needed anyway. And it's kind of, it seems tacked on now in fifth edition. And having, you know, as far as where your, like where people go when they die, which again, like who really cares? Like, when is this ever going to matter in your game? But I guess if you're doing high level stuff, it might, but it's the things we think about as DMs. But as far as where people go when they die in the game, you know, it could be in Primordia that there's a plane, maybe Hades, my god of death's plane, that's like the underworld. And that's where everybody goes when they die, unless they have a really strong connection to a particular deity other than Hades. So if you're a cleric of the goddess of magic, Tepestra, and you're all about Tepestra, then maybe when you die, you go to Tepestra's plane. But most people who worship all the gods or a few gods or no gods are going to go to Hades plane, which is kind of the afterlife that most people have. So that's kind of the way I'm leaning right now, but I'm still playing around with the idea of drastically changing the way the outer planes work, or even changing what they are. Because one thing I've been thinking about doing a lot with Primordia is taking a few very similar concepts and bringing them together. Concepts like the idea of a spirit world here in the real world, the world of dreams, or Teleranriad from the Wheel of Time, the warp from Warhammer 40K, this idea, or even the dreaming from Changeling the Dreaming. This idea of this other dimension, which is at the same time where magic comes from, at the same time it's where people go when they're having really vivid lucid dreams, and it's also where people go when they die, and it's also where the gods live. And if I go this route, it's going to be kind of like the idea of all of the outer planes in one huge plane. Because if you think about it, a lot of the outer planes, I believe the various levels are infinite, a lot of them. And I mean, infinite is infinite, right? I mean, you can't get any bigger than infinite. There's no infinite plus one, right? I mean, infinite is infinite. So it doesn't really matter if you have a bunch of separate infinite planes, or if you have a bunch, or if you have one infinite plane that has a bunch of different, areas within that plane or realms within that plane, each of which are themselves infinite. You see what I'm saying? Whether it's a bunch of different planes or it's all the planes are on one huge mega plane, it doesn't really matter. Conceptually, it doesn't matter mechanically. You'd still have to travel from one to another, most likely magically, because the planes are so, well, they're infinite and they're so far apart. Or, you know, you could have things like the River Styx that's a way to get from one plane to another, but there'd only be very specific ways you could do that. It'd still work the same way, whether the planes are in the wheel, like we have in the PHB and the DMG, or whether it's all on one huge plane together. And honestly, from the mortal perspective, you couldn't tell the difference between the two. And you wouldn't know. So I could easily say that people think it's the great wheel or the great tree or whatever, but it's really all just one huge plane. And I'm kind of leaning that way because it could correspond with the universe and how the universe is infinite. And it could just be like this universe, just another dimension, you know, to use more of a sci-fi term. So, you know, all the planes are really just another dimension of this universe is what I might do. But, you know, these are all things that you can think about in your world, and it's going to trickle down. You know, if you change the way the outer planes work, if you change the way alignment works or doesn't on the outer planes, it's going to affect your deities. It could affect how magic works. It's going to affect what happens to people when they die. It could affect or not what people believe happens when they die, and all kinds of stuff. So it's just all kinds of good stuff to think about when it comes to that. So anyway, huge tangent, bringing it back to bringing back the dead. Bringing someone back from the dead means retrieving the soul from that plane, whatever plane it is or wherever it is, and returning it to its body. Enemies can take steps to make it more difficult for a character to be returned from the dead. Keeping the body prevents others from using raised dead or resurrection to restore the slain character to life. You know, and that's something to think about when you're playing your NPCs or intelligent monsters is, you know, if resurrection magic exists in your world, then they probably know that. And if they don't want these heroes coming back to bother them yet another day, they might take steps to prevent resurrection or anything like that from being able to be used. Think it makes total sense. A soul can't be returned to life if it doesn't wish to be. Now, this is something I see people in actual plays forget all the time. You know, when someone tries to resurrect you or raise you or reincarnate you or anything like that, you get to choose if you come back or not. A soul knows the name, alignment, and patron deity, if any, of the character attempting to revive it and might refuse to return on that basis. So that's another thing. If someone tries to resurrect you, you know who is trying to resurrect you, what their alignment is, and what god they worship. So, you know, you can't really trick people with it. So, for example, if the Honorable Knight Sturm Brightblade is slain and a High Priestess of Tachesis, god of evil dragons, grabs his body, Sturm might not wish to be raised from the dead by her. Any attempt she makes to revive him automatically fail. If the evil cleric wants to revive Sturm to interrogate him, she needs to find some way to trick his soul, such as duping a good cleric into raising him and then capturing him once again when he's alive. So there you go. So, you know, this is interesting. And, you know, I think the most interesting thing about this is again, ramifications, right? So if resurrection exists, if this is a power people have and can use, then what does that mean for the world? What does that mean for the setting? What does that mean for the arch nemesis and things like that? You know, NPCs are going to be more likely to use spells like disintegration and any other methods they might use, maybe more mundane to prevent resurrection, like burning bodies or hiding bodies, things like that. And, you know, this can really have an impact on the kind of the flavor and the tone of your story. For instance, I've been reading The Wheel of Time again lately, and they have kind of a similar thing in The Wheel of Time. So a bit of a spoiler here, if you haven't read The Wheel of Time yet, but the kind of the evil god of The Wheel of Time is called the Dark One, and he has the power over death. And so when his servants are killed, he can, if he chooses, bring them back to life. It works interestingly in that, he has to put them in a body. So usually they take somebody and they take their soul out, and then he brings the person back into their body. Like, it doesn't recreate their old body. He just puts their soul in someone else's body, basically. So the heroes eventually discover that this is something that can happen, and decide that they need to use a specific weave or spell called Balefire, which completely obliterates you. It's kind of like a souped up disintegration, and makes it impossible for the Dark One to bring you back. So it's the same kind of thing, you know, as what you'd have in D&D with intelligent enemies that know maybe that, you know, the party has a patron or a cleric somewhere that can resurrect them. And so it's going to use disintegration or some other means to try to prevent that from happening, because they don't want to have to fight them again. So not only is that a way that you can add some more realism to your campaign, but it's also a way you could add some more danger and deadliness to your campaign as well, if you're wanting to turn up that difficulty knob a little bit. So that is the conclusion of the chapter on magic in the DMG. And I hope that, you know, this has maybe given you some food for thought to think about how you want to handle magic in your world. And, you know, you could have it change too. You could do what, like, Mike Schley was talking about last week in his world of Fern Way, where it's essentially starting out as a low fantasy world, low magic, and changing into high fantasy, high magic. And, you know, this is something, you know, we see different permutations of this a lot in fantasy. You know, a lot of times it's this idea of, in the ancient days, you know, powerful magics were done that can't be done anymore. You know, you have this in Forgotten Realms with ancient Netheril with their floating cities, and the elven high magic and circle magic way back in the day. I have the same kind of thing in Primordia with my old magic, which is what created the mythals that protect the city. And it's what created the portals that connect the cities that somehow work within and through the mythals when other teleportation and teleportation circles and things like that don't work. So those were all created by this old magic that people don't really understand anymore. And, you know, if you want to do that, that's awesome. And think about, you know, why is that? So for instance, in Primordia, I'm not going to tell you why, because it's a spoiler, but I can tell you that there's a very specific reason why there were old magics that were done in ancient times that can't be done anymore. And there are reasons why that is. And that's where, in my world, and in most, if not all, other D&D worlds, that's where artifacts come from, right? You know, usually the idea is that people aren't making artifacts anymore. These are ancient items that were made way back in the day when people could do things with magic that they can't do now, whatever the reason is. Is it just that people have lost the knowledge of how to do it, and people could do that magic today if they just figured out how? Or is it something more like the power of magic itself has somehow been reduced, or people's access to it has been reduced? I can tell you that in Primordia, I'll give you a little teaser. The ancient magics, a lot of them actually aren't possible anymore. And it had something to do with something that happened with the gods a long time ago in a period of time called the Consolidation, which sometime I'll have to talk about. But my next Primordia campaign, we're going to delve into some of that, so I don't want to spoil it. But during that time, the gods did some things that from then on kind of limited what could be done with magic, because some crazy things had been done with magic that they didn't want to happen anymore. I think we had something like this in Dragonlance, I seem to remember. It's been so long since I've read any Dragonlance, but I feel like in Dragonlance there was, in ancient times, they were able to cast more powerful spells than they can cast today. So, you know, for me, kind of thematically and mechanically, what the old magic is it's magic above and beyond ninth level spells. So in the player's handbook and in any future supplements that have spells in them, you know, that kind of spells out what magic does today and what player characters can do with magic. And kind of the upper limit of that is the ninth level spells, you know, ending at the spell wish, right? So the idea of the old magic, in my world at least, is, you know, at least in the past, there were magics greater in power than today's ninth level spells. And the magic that we have in the player's handbook and in the DMG in the form of spells and magic items is what's left. So the spells are what people can still use today. The magic items, you know, some of the more powerful ones were made long ago and maybe can't be made anymore, especially the artifacts, or they were made by the gods themselves and kind of represent kind of what's left of this ancient magic. So, you know, that's kind of how I handle it in my world. But again, in your world, you know, the sky's the limit as far as all the different ways that you could approach this. So I would just encourage you to think about it and think about whatever you decide, think about what the consequences of that are going to be. What are the ramifications of your setting being high magic or low magic or whatever it is? And I think if you can figure that out, then you'll be good to go. All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 163 of Game Master's Journey. If you would like to get a hold of me, please visit the website starwalkerstudios.com. There you can email me, find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube information, and more. Also, the Game Master's Journey voicemail number, where you can call and leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you might even hear your message on the show. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I would love to hear from you. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. Finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron by making a one-time donation by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon or by purchasing my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at starwalkerstudios.com. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.